Facing challenges and overcoming setbacks is part of doing business. Whether you have the expertise to survive them or not could mean the difference between success or failure. Welcome to We Are Women, featuring revealing conversations that provide invaluable insights into the success secrets of female masterminds. A must-listen for every entrepreneurial woman. Now here's your host, Janine Vosper.
Hi, it's Janine Vosper here, and welcome to this episode of the We Are Women podcast. With me today, I have Julie Randall. Now, Julie was a 50-year-old working mother with two teenage girls when in 2012, following a sudden seizure at work, she was told she had stage 4
metastatic.
Beautiful. Metastatic melanoma in her brain, pancreas, both lungs and liver. She only had months to live. Now, after making a promise to her distraught teenage daughters that she would not die, Julie refused to accept her terminal prognosis and set about researching her condition. So undeterred and showing remarkable resolve, Julie identified that there was a clinical trial in Portland, Oregon, and which was going to be her best and probably her only hope. Now, that hope was dashed when she was told that the trial was full. Only 70 places were available, and all of them set aside and filled by American citizens. So I've met Julie now, and I know that she's not one to take no for an answer. She nagged her way onto the trial where, after overcoming serious setbacks, she became known as Patient 71. Now, Julie's story of survival has been covered by 60 Minutes and has been recounted in her moving memoir, Patient 71. So today, 7 years on, Julie is cancer-free and possesses a perspective few of us will never know after tripping over that word. Because as I know, it's such a powerful word too. When we hear it, we just go into a little bit of panic. But welcome, Julie. I mean, your story is, it's quite phenomenal. And I'm so glad that you can be here 7 years on with us.
Yes, thanks for having me. My pleasure.
I'm going to let you tell us a little bit more about, you know, the story and what happened, because that was just I was going to say highlights, but I'm sure the highlights are lowlights or whatever, but they were just the, you know, dot points of it. But there's more to it, and there's more to the emotional part rather than just the story part. So I'm just going to leave it up to you, and you just want to, you know, tell me, tell us your story and why, you know, you were so, I mean, a lot of people get diagnosis and they do as much as they can, but you just went further than people are prepared to go because it wasn't easy what you did. So I'll let you share, please, Julie.
Okay, sure. So it started back 7 years ago. Oh, let me work it out. What's today? It's today the 3rd. So on the 21st of June, it's 7 years ago, I was a fit woman, or so I thought, very fit. I was training for an over 45s state of origin touch football tournament that I was about to play in about 3 or 4 weeks later. I had my 50th birthday and wasn't happy about turning 50 and called it my 40-10th birthday. And I thought I was quite funny doing that. And little did I know what was up ahead. But so about 4 days after my birthday, I was driving to work and I was in a really good place. I was driving along, singing, thanking the universe for everything in my life. And little did I know what was around the corner that day. So I got into the office and was there for a couple of hours, and the boss was taking a couple of us out to lunch there. So we walked down to, I worked in the city, the CBD of Sydney. We walked down to the Opera House area, Harbour Bridge there, and we sat down to a long, lazy lunch. And it was time to walk back to work and felt absolutely fine. You know, had maybe a glass of wine or two and got back to the office that day. Went up in the lift, walked back to my desk, and my boss, one of my bosses, asked me, "What did you have for lunch?" And I just stared at him, and I couldn't answer him. And apparently, what I came out with was, "I can't find my words." And in that split second, the feeling I had in my head was something I'd never experienced before, and I knew I was in trouble, just that it must have been about 3 seconds, and then my world just went black.
And that sort of thing, you know, I suppose my instant thought with that is stroke too, isn't it? You know, when...
Yeah, of course, that's
one of the indicators, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't have time to really even diagnose it, but yes, you're right, something like that, or an aneurysm, or there was just something wrong in my brain. So when I came to, I don't know, I still to this day don't know how long I was out for, but when I came to, my head was hanging down, I was staring down at the carpet, but there was paramedics and they were down on their haunches, like trying to bring me around, calling out, "Julie, Julie, Julie." And I could hear them, but I still couldn't speak. So finally I started sort of lifting my head bit by bit, trying to bring my eyes up. And as my head rose up, I saw all of my colleagues. I mean, at the time, I think there was about 7 or 8 of them with their jaws dropping onto the ground. So whatever I was doing, I'm sure it wasn't pretty, because they were absolutely stunned. They were horrified.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
And even just their reaction is probably more frightening than, because you couldn't see what was going on yourself, but just exactly. Seeing their reaction would have been really frightening.
Yeah. So with that, you know, I was, IVs put in, all sorts of things, and, you know, thrown on a trolley, and off I went to emergency at St Vincent's Hospital in an ambulance. And that was my last day on the job. My career was ripped from under me, as well as everything else.
And that's just even a little part of it. I know, you know, it doesn't become a priority when you've got, you know, you go through the processes that you went through, but it's an important part of who we are as well. You know, rather than just being a patient all the time, it's part of our identity when we're working.
Of course. Yeah, you're exactly right. Sort of at the time, it wasn't a biggie, but when I look back, I thought, wow, I lost a lot that day. Mm. I really lost a lot that day.
Absolutely.
So we carried on to St Vincent's, and, of course, all the phone calls had to be made to my family, and before I knew it, they were all pouring into the hospital. And I had a couple of tests, and it was identified that I had a tumour, left lobe, frontal lobe of my brain. But at that stage, they didn't know whether this tumour was malignant or what it was, so they had to do, you know, lots more tests to just check out what was going on with my whole body, etc. So my main concern was whether this tumour was malignant or not, and whether I could have just had this tumour removed and, you know, everything was going to be okay. But 24 hours later, the doctor, he was flanked by some trainees who I say were being trained to deliver bad news, and he just stood there and said, "You've got tumours in your brain, both lungs, your liver, your pancreas, your lymph nodes. You have stage 4 cancer. I'm sorry."
Julie, to interrupt there, but for me, you know, you're fit and healthy, you're running, you're training. I mean, there, other than when something drastic happened that it did in that workplace, was there anything that you led up to it thinking, "Oh, that's a bit odd," and still kept going on, or just was slap in the face.
Yeah, no, it was a slap in the face. Interestingly, a few months before I had had a little bit of discomfort, I guess you could say around the liver, but it was more just when I sat down. And sometimes us women, you know, we wear the tight bras and it's really uncomfortable. It's kind of a little bit persistent. And I went and had a CT scan and they said I had, I'm just trying to think of the word now, not tumours, but just basically innocent spots on my liver. And it sort of turns out that one of them have already been the melanoma. So I must have felt a little bit odd. But that was like 5 months prior and I'd forgotten about all of that and everything seemed okay. And, yeah, as I say, I mean, I look back at the photos, which are in my book, at my 50th birthday party, and if someone told you that girl standing there had stage four terminal cancer, you wouldn't believe them, you know? So it was, yes, totally out of the blue, that diagnosis.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to sort of, you know, get a symptom of something and then we check it out, but you didn't have any of that. It was just okay. Yeah.
I just felt amazingly fit.
Mm. And I don't want it, you know, I don't want it to be a scary situation for anybody, but that's the thing is you don't know. You just don't know really what's going on inside your body unless you're getting medicals and scans every few months to see what's changing.
Of course, and that's just, you know, the medical system sort of really can't cope with that. So that doesn't usually happen. Yeah.
No, absolutely. So, you know, that I'm a big believer of sort of, you know, plan for tomorrow but live for today. And I suppose that would have gone through your head as you're going through all of the treatments and what you went through as well.
Oh, absolutely. All these things that I was, you know, I say gonna, you know, G-U-N-N-A, all these things I was gonna do and didn't quite get around to doing, I would lay in bed and after this diagnosis and just think, what were you thinking? Everybody thinks they've got all the time in the world to do these things. And I actually promised Mrs. Universe that if we got out of this one that I would do all those things that I always promised I would do. Now, you know, it's very, very clear to me that exactly what you said before, totally agree, plan for tomorrow but live for today and get things done that you want to do.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely enjoy it. So, you know, you said you did the research with the stuff going on in the US, but I imagine there's time gone in between that before you found that program that you were, you know, dealing with the family and how they were coping with it and everything else.
Yeah, of course. So another little twist to the story was that after I'd had a biopsy to find out what type of cancer I had, it turns out it was melanoma, which is, you know, I had a week or something to think about it, and it wasn't what I, you know, it wasn't one that popped up for me because everybody thinks melanoma is, you know, you've had something on your skin, you've had it cut out, you've done this, you've done that. Now I had a few what's called basal cell carcinomas cut out of my skin, but I've never had melanoma and I had my skin checked all the time. So it was quite a shock when they told me what it was, and it's one of the deadliest cancers you can have. One person every five hours dies from melanoma. So
goodness.
I was reeling from that anyway. He says you have melanoma after this biopsy, and then without much, you know, time in between, he said, but I think that's a good thing because I've got this pill now that melts it all away, which sounds absolutely bizarre. When I tell people that, I, you know, even when I say it, I think, you know, what were you thinking? But we wanted to believe it. We weren't up with the melanoma world. We thought, okay, there's been some advances that we don't know about. So he sends us off to a professor who is a professor of melanoma. So we go over to Westmead Hospital out, you know, back of Sydney there, and she calls us into the room. We're waiting to get prescribed the magic pill. And she comes in and she says, you have, you know, already stage four advanced metastatic melanoma. I'm really sorry, there's nothing we can do. And with that, I guess I've left out the bit about promising my daughters I was going to live, because they were absolutely distraught and wailing, saying, no, Mum, no, Mum. And I promised them I would live. So I go over to get this magic pill, and, of course, there was nothing of the sort for my condition. So I'm like dry retching in the basin in the corner of this doctor's office, because I'd just been on this roller coaster ride of thinking I was gone, then told that I was not gone, then told that I was gone again. And all I could say was my babies, as I, you know, my teenage daughters. That's all I could think of. We as mothers, you know, they're our cubs, and they are the first thing that pop into your head. And I thought, how am I going to let them down again? And the doctor and my husband actually had to help me back to my chair. I was just a wreck. And then my husband's saying, what about the pill? What about this, you know, pill that the doctor said? And she just kept shaking her head. And it just turns out that there are all different types of melanoma, and that magic pill was not for me. And turns out it wasn't so magic after all. It sort of helped people for a short time, not a long time. So, yeah, it was a bit of hope, you know, but, yeah, got dashed very quickly. Mm-hmm. And then her assistant tried to hand me a brochure on palliative care. So all in that one meeting.
Gosh.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've got my hands up just going with my eyes closed, just almost pushing the air, but pushing her away, thinking, what are you thinking giving that to me? Like, and so I didn't accept it. But in amongst all the melee, and just to answer your question about the time lapse between the diagnosis and looking into clinical trials was about 5 or 6 months, because I was offered chemotherapy, but that was to hold things for a while. And if you could see me, I've got my hands up with the inverted commas. It was hold things for a while. It's never been a cure for anyone. But I had to take up the offer, because in my head I'm thinking, I've got to try something, because I've got to, you know, I need to make a plan. I need to. And this chemotherapy zone, I think it was two different ones were offered, but the one that I took up had 30% chance of holding things for a while, and so I did. I went on that, and it did. I was very lucky to respond to that. So it shrunk some of the tumours and seemed to keep them reasonably stable. But then one day in a doctor's appointment, I sort of had to ask the burning question. You know, I'd been on the chemo, I'd lost all my hair, I had all that side stuff going on. And I said, how long is this treatment going to last for? And he sort of said, quite matter-of-factly, well, put it this way, it won't be working in what was a few months' time. It won't be working. So I said to him, well, I'm not going to sit around and wait for that to happen. And he sort of just looked at us, and then my husband started saying, what about clinical trials, and what, there's got to be something we can do. And he sort of said, oh, there are clinical trials going on overseas at the moment. And my husband, Scott, said, well, can you refer us? And he just shook his head. He said, no. He said, if you want to go down that path. It's up to you. You're on your own.
So, and how did they feel? I mean, I suppose that they've got a lot of people that you know, they're dealing with patient after patient after patient. So you can sort of a bit of understanding of that. But I'm just, even as you're telling it, I'm thinking, I just want to give someone a kick, you know?
Funny you should say that. I was, I didn't kick him, but I was a little bit sort of harsh because, as you say, that's their job, you know. It's like somebody walking in and asking for a copy, and there's 100 of those every day, and he's just telling me the facts. He was just telling us the facts. And so I just, sort of bit his head off and said, well, I'm not going to wait around for that to happen. And it was that very day that we got in the car, and I don't think I still couldn't drive at that stage. I'd had my brain tumour removed in amongst all this, by the way. And that was another story in itself. Yeah, that's not, you know, not a nice operation. Anyhow, so that day after that was our local oncologist that told us, that this treatment's not going to be working. So we went home, and I just got on the computer and just started Googling melanoma clinical trials, over and over again, and just, it was a minefield, as you can imagine. But I found this clinical trial in Portland, Oregon, that was using a drug, which is an immunotherapy drug. It was called PD-1 at the time, which stands for Programmed Death of a Cell, blah, blah, blah. It's got a proper name now, but at the time that's what it was called. And I was just reading it, and it just, something resonated. It just made sense to me. It was a drug that teaches the immune system to go and fight the cancer. So our immune systems are fighting cancer every day, as we probably all know. But sometimes they get lazy, or the T cells are too busy and they go off fighting something else, and then the cancer slips through. So this particular drug goes in, sits on the T cells. It's not the drug that fights the cancer. It's actually, this drug is a protein. It goes onto your T cells and it teaches your T cells, hey, you've been lazy, you've got to go and fight the cancer cells again. And then they go out, and for the lucky people like me that it worked for, they go out and seek and destroy the cancer cells.
So it doesn't work for everybody?
No, it doesn't. Unfortunately, it only works for...
So what was the percentage that you were given?
Okay, so I was looking at 33% chance. Yeah, so it wasn't a lay down, Nazir, to me, but... something in my gut, and I always trust my gut rather than my head, said, Julie, that's where you have to be. You need to get that drug. So that's when I started my campaign, about 3.5 months, to be precise.
How long? 3.5 months.
3.5 months. Yeah.
And that's away from home in, a foreign country, although it's America.
The first hurdle was, there was a similar one going on in Spain, actually, but, I didn't even pursue that because I thought, the language barrier, and that's even further away from home, et cetera, et cetera. So I just didn't let up on this one. So I just started by a simple phone call. And I got onto the clinical trials nurse. I can be quite resourceful when I want to be. And he was a guy, and he was quite receptive. He sort of seemed, I think he was, looking back, I think it was more that he was kind of humouring me. I was this girl from Australia and ringing up to get into a clinical trial in America, and I think he sort of found that a little bit amusing and interesting. And he was a lovely guy, and turns out that this guy was instrumental in getting us there. But so the initial conversation was, we're having some success here with that. Like, it was first stages out of the rats. They were having some success. They didn't know the long-term data. Just between you and me, they still don't really, because I am a front runner now. But So he was sort of, yeah, as I say, humoured us, and then the nose started coming thick and fast. And I'd send an email, I'd get, no, sorry, Julie, you're not in our medical system, you won't be covered over here. You know, boom, that was it. And then they'd try to refer me back here to someone, and I'd always say, no, been up that alley, blah, blah, blah. Then we'll send you some money. So you can put that in the bank and, you know, if something goes wrong. And what I always laugh about is I kept telling them what a fit and healthy girl I was. Here yeah. I am in stage four cancer, dying with months to live.
But did you still feel fit and healthy?
Yeah, I did. You know, I mean, I just decided that with the chemo, and look, I've got a pretty good constitution anyway, I've got to say, but I just thought this isn't going to get me down. Like if I get sick, I'm not going to be able to get into this, you know, clinical trial. I'm not going to be able to do anything. So I sort of, I'd get a bit tired, but I'd force myself to walk, to run. And it was quite a running joke in the neighbourhood because the rumour was going around that, you know, Julie had stage four cancer, and someone would say, oh, no, she hasn't. I saw her running the other day. So I just kept it up and kept really healthy, went on a special diet because I knew they wouldn't accept me over there unless they thought I could. I mean, it's all about the science. It's all about the clinical trial, so that they want to get a, you know, as healthy as possibly can be, somebody in there that they can do this science, you know, their project on. And so they just had lots of reasons to say no, and know that I wouldn't stay long enough because I'd miss my family too much, and yeah, all different things. And in the end, it was just, no, we're full. We can't take any more patients. We're full. And the drug company has only allowed us 70 places. And then I rang up and recited the Hippocratic Oath over the phone, my version of it, my version of it, which was pretty black and white. If you have something that can save my life and save my family from heartache, or has a chance to save my life, I believe you took an oath. The doctors took an oath to do so. You know, we're all children of the universe just because I don't live in America. And then I, yeah, a few days later I got the call, and then I became known as patient 71.
That's brilliant. Yeah. I love that Hippocratic Oath. Come on, this is your job, boys.
Yeah, I know. I was so proud of myself. I was so proud of myself when I was running one day and it just popped into my head, and I just ran straight back home. Told my husband, who wasn't a fan. He said that might be just, you know, overdoing it a little bit, so I didn't even tell him. And I just rang and left the message, and I was promising them all sorts of things originally as well, saying to them, oh, you can come and stay at ours in Australia. I was trying everything, but, yeah, it seems to be that the oath was the kicker that made them go, okay, she's got a point.
That's brilliant.
Let's get her over here.
Yeah, and you can understand their point of view as well, but, I mean, they must be really happy because your results are their positive results they're looking for as well. So, I mean, after getting you there, that must have been a little bit of a bonus for them.
Yeah, well, it turns out it was, and it still is, because, yes, AI responded really well. I mean, I wasn't the best responder in the beginning. I was a slowly, but I just kept responding, which turns out that's a pretty good thing anyway. And then in part of my campaign, I would say to them, I'll do whatever it takes. If you bring me over there, I will work tirelessly for you. I'll do whatever. So I ended up taking on a project while I was over there for guest housing. So I was like, they call me their poster girl over there, which is quite funny. But I took on this project to raise money for guest housing because I had to stay in some pretty ordinary accommodation when I was there. And I sort of, they asked me about it, and I said, well, put it this way, it's, you know, it's pretty depressing, and it's, Look, I was grateful because I had somewhere to stay. But when you're going through something like that, living in depressing circumstances, doesn't help with your mindset. So, but I put my mind into doing that, and consequently helped them raise a hell of a lot of money. And now that's up and running, the new guest housing over there, and we go over and speak at fundraisers, and I've done a lot of little projects behind the scene for them. So it has, yeah, and just getting 60 minutes and showcasing the hospital, and they were able to play that to all their, what's the word I'm thinking of? Philanthropists and investors, yeah, and all that sort of stuff. And, yeah, so it's really been a win-win for everyone. So they're glad they took me on, but they did say, even they didn't play it on 60 Minutes, but when we were being interviewed over there with the doctor, he said, we all thought, oh, my God, what have we got coming over here? This girl is such a pest. She won't take no for an answer. So, yeah. And they said, but we were pleasantly surprised. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great. And look, Portland, I've been to Portland, so it's not a bad city to be in. It's not one that sort of jumps out at most people that they know much about, but it's actually a pretty city because it's on the river.
Yeah, I think that more people are getting exposed to Portland now, and they're sort of renowned for their microbreweries and things. We ended up loving Portland, but when we first flew in, it was cold, freezing, and grey, and yeah, so it took us a while to come around, but I would recommend it definitely as a holiday destination now. Oregon's beautiful.
Yeah, I have to admit, though, we did go through Oregon and Portland in summer, and that made a lot of difference because the sun was out and everything was blue. And
yeah, exactly. Once it came to summer, it was just like a different place, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, so you stayed there, but you've had to go back quite a bit as well. So, because I know you were trying to not be there all the time, but travel when you could.
Yes. So, being in such a volatile situation, we didn't know. I mean, I was always positive. I really, really was, and I just thought I can do this. I can make this. But the facts were, we didn't know if I was really going to make it, if I was going to get a recurrence or, you know, if you want to look at facts. Sometimes I don't like to look at facts. I just like to get my gut feel. So we would sort of travel around in between my infusions and just try and enjoy the place as much as we could. When my husband came over, he wasn't always there. I was there alone a lot, and that was the lonely, I can't even explain the loneliness of that, just being in that position, in, I guess I could call it substandard accommodation, and with my children at home and my family, who's just, they say what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Well, for me, that was the hardest part. But I was lucky enough that I did have people around me sometimes, and people flew over, so. Yeah, the hubby and I did some trips around, and a couple of times I snuck home to see my kids. I wasn't allowed, but I just did. I'd get out of the chair after my infusion and say, I'll see you guys in 2 weeks or whenever my next infusion was, head to the airport and come home and see my girls. Because like when I left that day to fly out for Portland, I left one of my teenagers at home, and the truth was that I didn't know if I was ever going to see her again. And even the doctor, the doctor said that in 60 Minutes, you know, and said, so she could have died here, and he said without a doubt. So, but I had to do, you know, in my mind it was, I kept remembering my mother's saying of no guts, no glory, you know, and I had to have that short-term pain for the long-term gain so I would be with her for a lot longer, you know, not just, you know, the voices in my head, the monsters would say, why are you going overseas when your daughter's at home? You know, you might not see her again, or you might not have much time with her. But I just had to go with my gut feel that I could stay alive and that I would be with her for a lot longer. And she was 19 and she's 26 now, and she's got mum.
Yeah, and that's the big, the big point of that. And look, even Julie, relating that back to people in their everyday life, you know, not dealing with what you had to deal with, but there's crap that we do day in, day out. Sometimes it might be working 18 hours. Sometimes it just might be dealing with different difficult people or, you know, whatever it is. But that big picture at the end, I mean, that's where a lot of people get distracted and don't reach that end goal or that dream or what they've got for themselves and their lives because of all the stuff that comes in between. As you said, you know, the voices in your head saying, you know, don't do this. Mm. And that, but you kept that as your focus and your goal. And that's what we don't, a lot of people don't do enough of, going, I don't care if I have to work 18 hours because at the end, that's going to be what I achieve. You know,
absolutely.
That's,
And just having, for me, it was the ultimate goal of staying alive. You can't. Life. Life, so you can't get much bigger than that. But I have definitely brought that back into my everyday life, and I believe 100%. If you don't give up, you'll get there. You know, I really do. And like with, I'm not saying trying to say that about some medical situations. Some medical situations when I was resilient and tough and didn't give up, wouldn't take no for an answer, and I made it. Look, there's probably some people out there that do exactly that and they still don't make it, and I need to respect that. So I'm not trying to shout out to say, you know, I mean, part of me did save my own life. I believe that. But some people are in more difficult situations. But with everyday life and an achievement of something you really want, you are, just goes without saying, you, I don't know why the universe works this way, but it does. You are going to be challenged at every level if something is worth having, I believe. I don't know. Do you agree with that, Janine?
Well, sometimes things, I've got two minds on that, Julie. Yeah. Sometimes when you're in the zone, you know, and you're definitely going towards what is your, it's your purpose on life.
Yeah.
And sometimes that just flows. You know, everything just goes. And again, that's very much that gut, you follow that gut feeling and there's a flow to it and you reach where you're going. But you then I do believe then the universe says, well, how dedicated are you towards
that's
that?
Exactly what I was going to say. How much do you want this and where's your dedication? It just wants to try you on that, doesn't it?
Like, yeah.
And because if it didn't, when you think about it logically, if it didn't, everyone would just be cruising through life, getting whatever they wanted, you know.
You know, you'd be the first person to agree that the challenges, and I think you've already said it already, those challenges make us a stronger people than we believe we can be. And then when we gain that strength and knowledge and ability, we're able to assist others. And I believe that's part of our purpose as well, is to, what we learn and gain is then to be able to share that with others so that they can see that there's a way through moments of trauma. And I know, you know, with your book, well, it is titled Patient 71, isn't it? With your book, that's exactly what that does. It provides you, other people, with the opportunity to just have more of that. And it doesn't have to be a medical condition. It's whatever's going on in their lives to go, no, this is, I won't accept this. This is where I'm going.
Yep, absolutely. And that's the message I get, well, the messages I get back from readers. Yes, there are patients, people going through cancer, lots of other things, but I've had many, many messages from just people that have read it. And like one girl sent a message, it's like she was struggling to get out of bed and for some reason she had the book on the bedside table and she started reading it and, you know, consequently she's re-enrolled in a uni course, booked a trip she wanted to go on because it's understanding that if you will get there, and there's a lot of people like that have got through bigger and tougher things than you, And I mean, I even thought that when I was going through it. Come on, Julie, there's, you know, there's always a worse story. And I just love, it's funny, my husband says, never go through it again, but I, not that I want to go through it again, but it's taught me so much. Even rewriting the book. Now, I wouldn't have done that. I would have believed the voices in my head that told me that it wasn't going to be good enough and no one was going to like it and, you know, everyone's going to think I was stupid. But I've now learned to change that and just, you know, we all know those fear voices are just trying to keep you safe. What they really mean is don't run across that six-lane highway, but they'll bring those voices into everything you do. That's a little bit different, outside the box, putting yourself out there. And I just sort of, I have a conversation with these voices now and I just say, okay, yep, thanks for your opinion, but, you know, I'm not going to get killed. I'm just writing a book. You know, I'm not going to die. It's okay. And then I go about doing these things I never would have done, you know, speaking in front of 800 people, you know, writing books, talking to you on a podcast. That would all, I would have told people they were dreaming if they told me I was going to do that, you know, 7 years ago. So it's amazing.
And we don't want it, and we don't want it to have, you know, for other people, you don't want it to have to be a life-threatening disease to go, I can do this. You know,
no, I know. That's what I like. That's before that. Yeah.
I remember reading Michael J. Fox's book called Lucky Man, and he believes he's had so much better life and able to contribute more as a human being since being diagnosed with Parkinson's.
Yeah, it's and I can concur with that 100% because I have as well, and there's been some challenges in my life because we did it very tough financially. We had to sell our family home and all that sort of stuff. So that was and is still challenging, I'm not going to lie. But apart from that, to be able to make somebody's life better or help them go and chase a dream and learn to deal with those voices that they're not real. Like I say, 90% of the time they're not real. There's something dug up from your childhood that you were scared of, or as I say, if you walked, you got onto the Harbour Bridge and walked towards the edge and went to jump, yeah, you're going to get a voice telling you not to jump. Well, that's the 5 or 10% that makes sense. But the rest of it's usually just hogwash, you know, hogwash to keep you safe in your comfort zone. And we've all got so much to give. And what you said before about the being able to go through these challenging dark times and come out the other end and share them with people and teach people, I almost feel it's my right in, you know, not my right, my job.
Responsibility. Yeah,
my responsibility. And I think that I would absolutely be shirking my responsibility if I didn't do whatever I can to help people, you know, in similar situations or help people navigate. You know, I know this is an Oprah saying, living their best life, but that's what we all want to do, right? And we feel so good when we are contributing.
Absolutely. I think that's part of, you know, what makes us better human beings is to be able definitely to do that. Now, I know you had some takeaway points that you wanted to share, you know, that all relate back to your story and your journey along the way as well.
Yeah, I've got a few of those. And the first one, you probably know that I'm, from the way I talk, how I'm passionate about this fear and the fear monsters in your mind trying to tell you to stay in your comfort zone. So my first takeaway would be to have a real, next time that fear comes up when you want to do something, you know, out of the comfort zone, and you'll get it. You'll get it in your, you know, in your gut and your solar plexus. And I say to just have that conversation as in like there's two of you. And I always say I'm a Gemini, so I always talk to myself anyway. But just say, is that, you know, is that really true? Is that fear really true? Is it real? And is it relevant for now? Is it relevant for me in 2019? You know,
that's a good point. Sometimes it may have been real in the past, but that's a great question. Is it relevant?
Yeah, is it relevant to me? And then, and try and remember just it's not the fear we felt when we were 10 or 13 and we were trying to, not necessarily anyway, you know, trying to navigate our way in school or find a cool group to hang out with or whatever. It probably wasn't even relevant then, but more so now for when we're taking on new challenges in our lives. And then the other question I like to ask myself, and it's ask myself how you feel if you make the next move towards living that dream or living that life I desire, just the next move. Because every time, I know when I take a move forward, I just feel so amazing. Like I started, I was a qualified, well, I still am, qualified life coach, but haven't done it for a long time. And my passion now is to coach people, mentor people through. And I had my, first client today, and we had our first session. I've been doing this for years, by the way, but not as a business. I've just been mentoring patients and people through it. So I want to do this as a business. So I had my first person today, and we had such an amazing chat, and she's got some fear around, stuff she wants to do in her life. And we had our initial chat, got off the phone. I felt so amazing. I felt so good, and I helped her with a couple of things. And there's no better feeling, I don't think, anyway. And then the other question, if I do these things, if I'm moving towards this life that I desire, how would it impact the lives of others, and how will I feel when I'm helping other people is a big one for me too.
Mm.
And last but not least, I've got four, is change your questioning to, I used to think, going back to, say the book example, years ago it would have been, oh, what if I can't, blah, blah, blah. Now I change my questioning to what if I can? What if I can? What if people like it? What if it helps people live a better life? And how's that going to feel? How good's that going to feel? And focus on the can, not the can't.
I love that statement. What if I can?
Yeah.
It's a switch around, isn't it? And it's that, because that's one of the things that I talk about all the time, is about stepping out of, well, I don't call it a comfort zone, I call it a confinement of anxiety.
Yeah.
But stepping out of that confinement or out of your comfort zone by just making simple little statements to yourself, just as you've said, what if I can?
And straight away it'll change the way your posture, it'll change everything, because you're feeling what can happen when you can. And that's what I started when I started writing the book. I had the monsters jumping around like crazy, and I just thought, what if I can? What if I can? And I'm now almost over 9,000 book sales with people thanking me for giving them hope, changing their lives, whatever it is. And I never get, I'm humbled every time, every single person that sent me a message. I just think, wow, how privileged am I now being able, be able to do that for others. So,
That's a very powerful tool to have. And congratulations on having your first client today too. That would have been even a moment of can I, can't I, or can't I, can I type of thing, wouldn't it?
Yeah, of course. And I'm certainly not free of any of these monsters or voices in my head still. I've just learned how to handle them a bit better. But, yeah, it was. It's just a little bit nerve-wracking. Okay. And once again, I could have found an excuse and said, sorry, I'm busy today. Can we do it next week? You know what I mean? Through that anxiety and I would have done that years ago. And now I go, sit down. Let's do this. Let's start. Mm. start this ball rolling here. And my client, she's a woman, and we were just both so happy. And she told me then, she sent me a message a bit later and told me that her husband said that he's never seen her with a spring in a step like that for a long time.
Oh, wow. Isn't that fabulous?
Yeah.
It's all those good points. It's just absolutely the same as why I love doing what I do, Julie. It's why I do the podcast. It's why I do, you know, a lot of things. It's because of exactly that reason. It's just to be able to see the change in other people and help them along the way into what they're doing. You know,
yeah.
It's always lovely being paid for it. I mean, that's part of what I do as well, and putting value on my time and information. Same for you now. That's having a client rather than, you know, just a conversation with somebody. But I wouldn't not be able to do it.
No.
And that's what you're probably finding now too. You can't not do it.
Oh, exactly. And you know, even the hubby said a couple of weeks ago, because I try to, you know, shuffle my time around, but this is the important stuff to me. And, you know, and he said, he says, oh, maybe you could just park this for a while and just do it. And I said, no, I won't be parking this for a while. This is who I am. This is what I do. There's people to help.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I'll make it work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, having been what you've been through, part of what you're saying is, well, we're not parking anything for a while.
Yeah.
It's just,
how dare he tell me to park anything? Yeah. But he had my best interests at heart, I'm sure, but that wasn't happening. So now I want to, big aspirations in doing a lot more speaking and polishing that up. And I'd love to write another book more around what you and I have discussed today, around dealing with the mind and how it can, you know, scare us to death into almost, you know, we become frozen by fear. And, lots of other things. I've got a big card, Janine. I've got a lot to do.
I keep saying I'm living to 125. It's the only way I'm going to fit in everything that I've got on my list to do. So
I know, but it keeps you going, right? Doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it just is, you know, it does. It keeps you moving forward all the time. So, Julie, how can people get in touch with you? Because if someone wants to work with you, that's cool. And then also, how can they pick up your book?
Oh, okay. So we doing some work with me. Tweaking the website at the moment because there's a couple of things that we have to add to it. So probably is available. Just trying to think about she was working with the contact.
This won't come out until about September, October.
Oh, okay, so cool. I know,
it's going to be for those listening now.
Okay, no worries. Okay, so it is julierandall.com.au. So that's julierandall.com.au. Mm-hmm. And that is the website. You should be able to contact me through that. And, well, they can get onto the email as well through that, but I just might give you the email. So it's jrandall02@optusnet.com.au. And, of course, you can find me at patient71 on Instagram and Facebook. And if anyone's interested in picking up a copy of the book, patient71, I say the best place is Booktopia. They, don't charge as much as the publishers, and they'll send it straight out to you. Or you can go into your local bookshop and they'll order it for you straight away.
Excellent. Oh, no, that's fantastic. Look, your story is, you know, always amazing. I've heard it a couple of times now, and I'm just inspired by it each time I hear it. I'm sure the listeners will be as well, and, you know, understanding that there's a destination you want to get to, then it's worth what you have to do to absolutely get there, especially when your life depends on it. But we're not always in that place, but we, you know, for what we want as our dream for ourselves, it's worth the journey. Thank you so much for being on with me today, Julie. It's been a really interesting conversation, and I'm sure the listeners have got so much value out of it.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
You're welcome. And that's this episode of the We Are Women podcast. I am Janine Vosby, your host, and you can get in touch with me by jumping on my website at any time. and it is janvenvosper.com.au, and leave a 5-star review when you can. Thank you. I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
So, do you feel stuck in a rut in business? Visit speechperfect.com.au and download Janine's free ebook to avoid the 5 most common stumbling blocks women face in business. It's jam-packed full of tips to overcome the barriers that could be holding you back from the success that you dream your business will be. We would love you to leave a review of today's episode and share this podcast with other women in need of entrepreneurial inspiration. Subscribe to the next episode now and join the We Are Women community.